Later on in the lesson, I'll talk about someone who had to tell someone else, it's time to go. I needed that nudge just now to know for sure whether it was time to start or not. We'll come back to that. This is a great opportunity for me, really near the end of Daniel and Beth's time with you all, to express gratitude. I thought about it yesterday, and I thought, well, maybe I have this opportunity when the whole church is here to say how grateful I am for the care that you've given them. Especially for those that have mentored and taught Daniel, challenged him in many ways, for Jeff and for Brent and Randy, others who have pushed him, I know more than I even understand and know, for Paul and Jan and their motherly, fatherly care, and others of you I know that in many ways have made this year easy. The other thing you have done for him, by the way, is this was his first year of marriage. Came up yesterday in our class that, I think it's in Deuteronomy 24, that you know when a man was first married, for a whole year he didn't have to go out to battle or have any business. And he was free to stay home and to make his wife happy. You'll have to think hard about why that came up in the class yesterday. But anyway, it did. But you have given Daniel and Beth that year of opportunity, maybe, of to being free from care. And now it's time, in short time, for him to be sent out to battle, maybe. That's a way to think of it as well. So I appreciate that. And I appreciate the time that the men spent yesterday. I think I talk way too much, and in a multitude of words, there does not want transgression, I think is maybe one thought. It was way too much to say, probably, to have gotten it all right. But I think the real benefit will be that those men were thinking more seriously about their roles as men in their families and as fathers, and maybe we've pointed them to the ultimate source of wisdom, which is the truth of God revealed, and we will all of us be challenged to do differently as a result of that study as well. And so here I am this morning preaching the lesson that in some ways is the tail end, or maybe it's the culmination or something, of this weekend on leadership, although apparently it's the end of VBS and a bunch of other things too, so I don't know how to cover all that. But it would seem like the right thing to do would be have a lesson that kind of summarizes all there is to say about leadership, the final crescendo, you know, the punchline. What is it really all about? And so I chose this topic, the secret of effective leadership. Whoops, okay, I'm going to have to get the rhythm right. And, you know, that's a challenging topic. Where I work, I, on occasion, am involved in teaching some short courses, a continuing education, usually engineers, who are not necessarily people-oriented. But I have, one of the modules I teach is on leadership. One of our exercises is to just open the questions, get some involvement. What is leadership? You get all kinds of answers. And you can survey the literature about leadership, which, by the way, comes mostly from corporate leadership, leading companies. There's a challenge there in making that analogy to the church. Probably some things that are not right about it. There are lots of quotes of famous people who are leaders. I think it was Rosalind Carter said, leadership is getting to people to do something that they ought to want to do, but don't. Or something similar, I think Truman said, leadership is getting people to do something that they don't like and like it, or something like that. And they get simpler as you keep thinking about it. I think it was John Maxwell just said something like, a leader is someone who has followers. That makes it a little simpler. Maybe the most reduced definition of all is a leader is someone who has influence, who changes someone's behavior in some way, whether that represents necessarily following them personally or not. Well, that's not such a good approach to look at secular literature. Maybe the thing to do is to do what you do often preparing for a sermon, a concordant search of the Bible. Look up the term leader. And I know a lot of you have electronics with you this morning. You don't have to pay attention. If you want, go do a word search on the word leader, if you want to. And I'll tell you, there's a lot of term that shows up a lot in the Old Testament, over 100 more times. But it's always describing a person, and they're the leaders of Israel, they're leaders of nations or something. When you come to the New Testament, depends on the translation, of course, but there's only four times that word leader comes up, and they're none of them good. Blind leaders of the blind is the one that comes to mind. Maybe it's not the best of all of them, right? But in general, it's referring to the leaders of the Jews and their, you know, their conspiracy to kill the Savior. And this is what we can find in a concordant search about leadership in the New Testament. So where do I go? Well, then the thought is, of course, Jesus is our example in everything. As a leader, as a ruler over his kingdom. And that's the way he's presented. And where else and where better to go? And I'm not joking about this now, to look at Jesus' leadership. So a passage that comes to mind, which I learned from listening to a sermon of Daniel online, is quoted more than any other psalm in the New Testament, is this Psalm 110. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. The Lord sends forth from Zion your mighty scepter. Rule in the midst of your enemies. I know it's the case when we talk about leadership, especially with regard to the roles of men and women and in our society, there is this insecurity, sometimes hostility about the idea of being in a role of positional leadership, of being a ruler. And the reason is the opportunity in that position is to abuse others, to act selfishly, to make decisions and force others to follow those decisions for our own benefit, to act selfishly. We understand that the great Messiah does not act that way, and yet this is a pretty harsh, iron-fisted kind of a description of his rule. In fact, if you read on in the psalm to the latter verses, there's some violence involved. There's warfare imagery, and those who are injured or destroyed in a physical way comes later in that psalm as well. Interesting point. But the next verse is what I really want to focus on, which is, I think, the secret of effective leadership. Your people, you see the contrast there? He rules over his enemies. They're in trouble. They'll be destroyed with violence, right? They don't have a choice. They will not willingly submit, and so they are destroyed by his power and might, enabled by God Almighty. But your people will offer themselves freely on the day of your power in holy garments. Do you see a difference there? And so I'm kind of almost done with the lesson. The secret of effective leadership is you have people who willingly follow you. And what a great relief from worrying about whether I'm qualified or making all the decisions perfectly or whatever. And that phrase itself actually came to mind as well. There are maybe at least two other places in the Old Testament where that phrase is used almost exactly the same. You can see in that phrase the image of sacrifice, can't you? The people willingly offer themselves, the sense that they are coming forward to sacrifice themselves. Their own benefit has been put aside, and whatever the cause is, they are sacrificing for that. Here's one instance where that's used. It's in the book of Nehemiah. And here the city of Jerusalem is trying to be rebuilt under the leadership of Nehemiah. And so what happens is there's this need to have people not only to populate the cities, which perhaps is their inheritance or the homeland, but also to be in Jerusalem. And so they cast lots. The leaders of the people lived in Jerusalem. The rest of the people cast lots to bring 1 out of 10 to live in Jerusalem, the holy city, while 9 out of 10 remained in the other towns. And the people blessed all the men who willingly offered to live in Jerusalem. I'm not sure whether it was a good thing or a bad thing to have to be 1 of the 10, to have to go live in Jerusalem. But it appears that it wasn't such a great thing because the people were blessed because they willingly offered themselves to go and live in Jerusalem. But the place that's more exciting and where the rest of the lesson will come from is from the book of Judges. And you may perhaps know this particular verse. In Judges chapter 5, it says that the leaders lead in Israel. And by the way, I should just stop and say that is just very difficult to translate. And there's a lot of variation in that. And so the fact that it's difficult to translate probably means I shouldn't spend as much time on it as I'm about to. But I'm going to anyway. You may have in your version something else, leaders lead. I think there's translations that say things as strange as the locks are flowing or something. In the Hebrew, it's the same word but different versions of it, which can mean something like the beginning or the loosing or something. So it might be the beginning of the loosing or the loosing of the beginning or something. I don't know. The Septuagint translated with the word that I think is the title of the book of Revelation, two different forms of that word, about the showing or the uncovering or the revealing or something like that. So it could be the uncovering of the revealing or the revealing of the uncovering or something. But it's something to do with that. Something happened in Israel. Something exciting changed. And I think, as we'll see in a minute, this is the beginning of a poem. And if you will turn to Judges 4 and 5, that's where we'll be the rest of the time. It may be parallel to the end of the chapter, where after this great victorious poem, Deborah says, let all your enemies perish, but let those who love him be like the sun when it comes forth in full strength. So this beginning of the song is about some new revelation, breaking, dawning of some leaders or some loosing or something. And it ends by saying the sun came out. And this darkness was displaced by some wonderful things that happened in the destruction of God's enemies. You see that in the song. So whatever it means, it's an exciting beginning to the poem. And I think it has to do, really, with the beginning of leadership. But how was that leadership enabled? And here's the key point. When the people willingly offered themselves. That's when it happened. And now what I'd like to do is look at the story that surrounds this. It's really found one other place. In fact, it says here, my heart is with the rulers of Israel who offered themselves willingly with the people. Bless the Lord. That's down in verse 9. So I'd like to think about the story here about Deborah and Barak. I hope maybe some of the kids have studied this recently and know the details. If you have, you can correct me on things that I get wrong. So I'm going to retitle the lesson. We've covered that already. What's the secret of effective leadership? And that is the people offer themselves willingly. Now that's the new title of the lesson, and we'll work from there to figure out what that actually means. And maybe with this as an example. Well, here's the situation in Israel. First of all, spiritually, they're not in good shape. This is 100 years after Joshua has come and conquered the land. The city of Hazor kind of plays prominently in this story. A man named Jabin. There was another man named Jabin and another set of people in Hazor 100 years before that Joshua burned to the ground. And yet they've come back again. How did that happen? So 100 years later, and maybe 50, 40, 30, I don't know, years after Shamgar, Ehud and Shamgar, those kind of exciting lone rangers that did great work for the Lord. But here they are now again sinning in the sight of God. Chapter 4, verse 1. Ehud was dead. The children of Israel did again evil in the sight of the Lord. You go over to verse 5. I should explain this if you don't know. Chapter 5 is a poem of victory. And in many ways, we learn more about the battle and the details of what happened from the poem of Deborah, the celebration song in chapter 5. So we'll look at both 4 and 5 together as we go to understand what's happened. 5, verse 8 says, they chose new gods. And so there was a sense of idolatry that led to that situation. You can go back to chapter 2, for example, and see how this story was building. You shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of the land. You shall tear down their altars. But you have not obeyed my voice. Why have you done this? Therefore I say, I will not drive them out before you, but they shall be thorns in your side, and their God shall be a snare to you. Over to chapter 3 and verse 4. And they were left that he might test, these are the nations of Canaan, they were left that he might test Israel by them to know whether they would obey the commandments of the Lord, which he commanded their father by the hand of Moses. And they didn't keep them. And these nations were there as tests, and that's exactly what's happening then here in chapter 4. I should speak briefly about the domination, the military status. There had been a 20-year domination by the Canaanite nation. And we'll see a map in just a minute. But you'll see that Hazor's at one end, and this we'll see it when we get there, is down in probably in the southeast side, probably nestled up into the cliffs or the valleys of the Carmel Range where the chariots are. And what you see here is there's this great disadvantage. Keep reading. The Lord sold him into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. That's up in the northeast. The commander of the army was Sisera, who dwelt in Harosheth Hagoyim, all right? And somehow Harosheth of the nations. I picture that as kind of a bat cave. I don't really know why, but the best idea of the site of that is a place along the Carmel Range where there was a valley, maybe only about a mile wide, but a great place maybe to keep your chariots and bring them right out on the plain where chariots operate the best. But the children of Israel cried out to the Lord, for Jabin had 900 chariots of iron. 900 chariots of iron. Do you realize those are tanks? They're like tanks compared to foot soldiers and just ordinary army men. They're iron. And you come into battle with horses, and those people that are not trampled by the horses are run over by the chariots. And I assume there's a driver in the front and a sharpshooter in the back with a spear or arrows or something, and he's taken out men. So you're able to shoot without having to worry. You're moving fast. You're running over people, and he had 900 of them. They were made out of iron. interesting later in Deborah's description of things, see, she says there was not a shield, chapter 5, verse 8, not a shield or spear was seen among 40,000 in Israel. So it wasn't like they were running over heavily armed men. They were running over people who didn't have weapons at all. And you can kind of see that. I think back in chapter 1, there's a similar reference. Chapter 1, verse 19, the Lord was with Judah. This is a problem with the Philistines, perhaps. And they drove out the mountaineers, but they could not drive out the inhabitants of the lowland because they had chariots of iron. Very powerful things. And I'll just tell you, chariots come up through this whole thing. It's interesting to see how many mentions there are of that, of chariots. Almost every time Sisera is mentioned, chariots are associated with him. Verse 7, Jabin's arm. I meant to say Jabin. I will get those mixed up. I won't admit it. Sisera's the captain. Jabin's the king. With his chariots and his multitude, back down to verse 13, Sisera gathered his chariots. Verse 15, the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots. An interesting thing at the end of the Song of Deborah, there's this picture that Sisera's mother, another mother, but not in Israel, but in Canaan, is waiting for Sisera to return. And she's thinking, why is this taking him so long? And her thinking about him is, why is his chariot so long in coming? Why tarries the clatter of the chariot? Another mother is thinking about her son. Oh, he's just delayed taking the spoils of battle. But he's associated with chariots. Few weapons in Israel, and as a result, they could not hold on to the plains. We learn later in the time of Saul that the Philistines had a technological advantage. The Israelites were not even able to sharpen their own farm implements, much less make swords and that kind of thing. If they wanted them sharpened, they had to go down to the Philistines to get that done. And there's that one battle where Saul and Jonathan are preparing to fight the Philistines, and there's nobody has any weapons. They're all there without any weapons at all. And so that's the military situation. Commerce and social life had come to an end. In the poem, chapter 5, verse 6, the highways were deserted. The travelers walked by the byways. Village life ceased in Israel. And perhaps in chapter 5, verse 8, after it says they chose new gods, there was war in the gates. That almost suggests a kind of, at least, such an insecurity that it really wasn't safe in the cities. You might be attacked at any time. Or it may be even that there's some anarchy associated with the fact that they just couldn't establish any kind of rule in this lack of civil leadership. So life was miserable. It was a dark time. Dark time spiritually, militarily, civilly, in every other way. There was little national unity. Part of that maybe was God's plan, that he should be king over them. But when you disobey God, you left even that unifying factor behind. There was no leadership, no leadership in Israel. Here's a map that might help show the geography of that a little bit. So Barak is up here. Deborah's down kind of off the map to the south. It's the palm tree where she worked. Here's that area, Harosheth Hagoyim, where maybe the chariots were kept. And Hazor's up here. And you see Jabin here, Sisera here. There's this kind of dividing diagonal that just keeps the nation divided. Cuts them right off. And that's the area where the big roads come through for the trade and travel. So they had this alliance. And by the way, these were Canaanite. These were not the Babylonians or the Assyrians. These were people left among them that were conquering them in their own land, in their own backyard that they could not control. So a difficult time. So let's talk about the battle quickly. I hope you know the story, but we'll go through it and see. So first of all, Deborah calls Barak to his duty. Look at chapter 4, verse 6. She sent and called for Barak, the son of Abinoam. By the way, is it Barak or Barak? I don't know. So in the south, we'll say Barak. The son of Abinoam from Kedesh in Naphtali, and said to him, "Has not the Lord God of Israel commanded, go and deploy troops at Mount Tabor? Take with you 10,000 men of the sons of Naphtali and the sons of Zebulun. And against you, I will deploy Sisera, the chariot, the commander of Jabin's army with his chariot." Did I mention the chariots before? Yes. "And the multitude of the river Kishon, I will deliver him into your hand." Barak said to her, "If you will not go with me, then I will not go. If you will go with me, I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go." So she said, "I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, there will be no glory for you in the journey you're taking, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman." Deborah rose and went with Barak to Kedesh. What do you think of Barak as a leader at this point? You know, Deborah introduces this problem by saying, I guess maybe it's not just rhetorical. Has not God commanded, go and... I don't know, did Barak have a duty that he should have already figured out? After all, it's kind of his tribe that's in trouble. Should he have taken leadership already? She has to nudge him into action, say, you know what, I think you should get going here. This is the word of God I'm telling you. And he says, no, I'm not going to go unless you go with me. What kind of a leader does he seem to be here? Where he's so insecure that without her presence, perhaps as talisman or some type of divine guidance, he has to have her go. She said, apparently not maybe the best thing to say, because she said, well, the result is there will not be glory to you as a result of that. We'll go to someone else. So she calls him to his duty, and then he calls others to theirs. He makes the call to the Israelites in verse 10. Barak called Zebulun, Naphtali to Kedesh. He went up with 10,000 men under his command, and Deborah went up with him again. So what happens there is they gather the men down to Tabor, and that's what Deborah said to do back in verse 9. They gathered the people to Tabor. Now, I'll just show you a picture of, this is not the best picture, but you can kind of get the sense of that. Tabor is kind of a conical mountain out on the plain where, by the way, I mentioned the chariots do very well on the flat land. And so 10,000 men start gathering around this mountain. It's not that huge. There is no way to gather 10,000 men secretly in that mountain. I don't know that they tried, but I could just imagine them all kind of trying to get down behind things and sneak up in different ways. It was very clear to Sisera down in the valley. In fact, the word came to him. We learned that in verse 10 that they were there. There's no secret in that. And perhaps it was a little bit of a place of peace, a security, because up in the mountains, the chariots can't get up there. It's pretty steep. They wouldn't be able to fight up there, so that's where they gathered. And now you see why this phrase, willingly offered themselves, has a little bit more meaning. The way this battle was going to work is, when the word came it was time to go, they were going to launch themselves down that steep hill into the valley where, guess what? Yes, the chariots would be. And that's where they fight best. And it's not just chariots and horses. And by the way, Israelites weren't great with horses. They were kind of into donkeys. You actually see that in the poem as well. They were launching themselves foolishly, perhaps, down into the flat area where the battle would take place. And so the sense of willingly offer themselves, I think, makes some sense. So there they are. I imagine Sisera in the valley looking up and thinking, what are they going to do? And then maybe when they started to come down, you could imagine him saying, no, those idiots. What are they doing? They launched themselves down the valley. And I imagine up on Tabor, that Barak and his men, those 10,000 men, I can imagine them all kind of quietly waiting. What do we do here? What's the plan? What are we going to do? And there's kind of an anxiety about that as well, to see how will this battle go, and in the moment before the battle. So what happens is, once again, Deborah gives the signal. Verse 14, Deborah said to Barak, up. I don't know if she went up or up. I don't know how she did that. But she said, you know, it's time to go. And it may be the storm was gathering, which we'll talk about in a minute. Maybe the timing had to be just right. But somehow, she said, up. For this day is in which the Lord has delivered Sisera into your hand. I like these past tense references, as if it's already happened. Before it has actually happened. Has not the Lord gone out before you? And maybe she was referring to the weather. We'll see that in a minute. But I think it's that, you know, this is already over. This has been done. God will take care of that. So Barak went down. Now he's in front, finally. Went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following. And I'm just thinking Sisera saying, what is this? This is going to be a slaughter. This should be an easy thing to do. And chapter 4, verse 15 easily just summarizes, the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army with the edge of the sword before Barak, and Sisera alighted on foot from his chariot and fled away on foot. And so it's hard to see from that very brief description what actually happened. But I think we can go over here to chapter 5 in the poem and get some sense of that. Verse 4, Lord, when you went out from Seir, when you marched from the field of Edom. The earth trembled and the heavens poured. The clouds poured water. The mountains gushed before the Lord. This Sinai, do you see the reference there? What happened at Sinai in that mountain? Lightnings, thunders, frightening things that scared people. That's what it was like. Down to verse 19 in chapter 5. The kings came and fought. The kings of Canaan fought in Taanach by the waters of Megiddo. They took no spoils of silver. They fought from the heavens. The stars in their courses fought against Sisera. The torrent of Kishon swept them away. Kishon is not a torrential river. I don't suppose most of the time, maybe ever anymore. But in this occasion, it was a giant flood. It overflowed its banks. The lightning and thunder apparently frightened the horses. In fact, reading on there in verse 9, it says, the horses' hoofs pounded, the galloping of the steeds, verse 22. That might be a reference to their discomfited nature, you know, panicking and rushing and being out of control as horses. But that's how the battle was won. When they charged down, God sent rain, gushing rain to flood the river and bog down the chariots, and thunder and lightning to frighten the horses, and the whole thing was easy. And Sisera was defeated. In fact, it maybe explains why he jumped out of his chariot and started running. If your chariot worked, you'd stay in it and go as fast as you could. But he jumps out and runs really in the other direction. And they were pursued down there to the southwest, as we talked about. But he went the other direction. And we know the story about how he was killed then later on by Jael, who was a Kenite, in the tent. You probably know that story maybe more than all the others, because it is a pretty exciting story. Why were Kenites in tents? How did that work? Who were they? They show up before in the time of Jethro. They're related to that. They show up later in the time of Jeremiah as Rechabites in some way. But they live in tents, and that's important. That's their lifestyle. And a woman who was a Kenite actually had the honor of killing Sisera, who was Jehovah's enemy. How do we offer ourselves willingly? So I'm not a regular preacher, and I'm always thrilled when my sermons have 3 points to them, and I have 3 points. And the way I do that is I have really long introductions, and sometimes I even have to start at -4 to get it to come out to 3 points, but I really only have 3 today left to do, and that is, what is it that we can see about how to offer ourselves willingly? Number one, I think we have to show up. I'm going to do this a little out of order, but I want to go over to chapter 5, verse 15, and the fourth phrase in that. Among the divisions of Reuben, there were great resolves of heart. You know, all the tribes had opportunity to participate and offer themselves willingly to Barak, whatever kind of a leader he was. And Reuben had great resolves of heart. Reuben was with him in spirit. Reuben wanted it to go well. They had something at stake. They would benefit, actually, from the victory if it happened. Maybe not as much as Naphtali and others that were right in the vicinity. Why did you sit among the sheepfolds to hear the pipings for the flocks? The divisions of Reuben have great searchings of heart. You know, we have here in this church and in other churches all kinds of initiatives, leaders that are teachers or elders or those who are trying to get with the young people, trying to reach the lost in some evangelistic effort. And we're for them, aren't we? We have great resolves of heart, but we sit at our sheepfold because we're busy people. The sheep have to be looked after. God knows we have to make a living, right? And that's okay. But here in this situation, they just sat among the sheepfold waiting for the right time. Gilead stayed beyond the Jordan, verse 17. Why did Dan remain on the ships? They were busy people. You know, these ships need maintenance. They have to be watched after all the time. It's just too hard for us to get away. I have a job that keeps me quite busy all the time. And we've got a lot of activities. They're good things to do. They make us better people. They keep our children off the streets and so on. And we're just busy, too busy to do that. Asher continued at the seashore and stayed by his inlets. I have an idea that they perhaps did not have the great resolves of heart. Yeah, you know, we should go now. We should get involved in that. But, yeah, well, maybe a better opportunity will come along later. But these just maybe didn't care at all. And worse than that, down to verse 23, curse Meroz, said the angel of the Lord. Curse its inhabitants bitterly because they did not come to help the Lord, to help the mighty of the Lord against, to help the Lord against the mighty. We could argue about whether the Lord needs help or not, but there's something special about Meroz. Oh, a curse, an angel cursed them. And you know, we don't know where Miraz is. Maybe that's the curse, that they just died and went away. I don't know. But there's one idea that seems to make sense. They may actually have been up near Hazor. That village may have been up there. And they may have had some type of an alliance that made it difficult for them to actually support the Israelites. That makes some sense to me, because they're cursed as traitors somehow. I wonder sometimes if things were called to do in God's work by those who could be leaders if they had willing followers, we're not going to do because we've already made an alliance with evil. We're already addicted to something that gets in the way in our lifestyle. We'd feel hypocritical because of what we know is going on in our life in some other way. And so we're just not involved just because that's just not our loyalty. We have a loyalty somewhere else, as in the case of Miraz. So point number one is at least show up. Let me get through these. Okay, point number two, besides just showing up, and that is come and bring what you have. These are interesting points to me. Look over at chapter 5, about verse 13. 14 maybe, we'll skip to there. From Ephraim were those whose roots were in Amalek, and after you, Benjamin, with your peoples. Who are these people whose roots are in Amalek, and why is that important? Ephraim brought experience. Amalek was an enemy. I think it's literally roots were against Amalek. They had experience in battle, and that would be important. The Benjamites also came. You may know about the Benjamites, of whom was Ehud and Saul and some of David's men who gathered together with him, who could fight with either hand. They could take a sling with either hand, left or right, and they could fight. So they were skillful in battle. But there were others who came, verse 14. From Machir, perhaps part of Manasseh, rulers came. Actually, literally, it's lawgivers, people who are maybe administrators, repeaters of the law. And for Zebulun, those who bear, now my translation says recruiter staff, but it's literally the writing instruments. So now, along with these Benjamites, maybe slinging slings with both hands, and those experienced warriors of Amalek, here are these people that are kind of like administrators who came. And some other people that had writing instruments. And you can imagine they're all kind of hunkered down there on the top of Tabor, and they're around the campfire waiting for the word. And they look over there at those guys and say, who invited those guys? What are they going to do? And so some people have put that together and say, well, they're administrators and they're writers. Maybe they were the recruiters, and that's why it's translated the way it is. Maybe that's right. Maybe that's right. And maybe the point is that whether they were warriors or not, maybe they were just scribes and they were real good with the writing instrument, but they showed up anyway to do what they could do. And maybe they might be useful in sending messages or something like that, keeping track of the people in some way. But they were there, bringing what they had and using what they had as servants, people willingly offering themselves. Issachar, it even gets better, verse 15. Issachar, the princes of Issachar were with Deborah. As Issachar, so was Barak, sent into the valley under his command, literally at his feet or on his feet. Whatever he said, that's what they were going to do. However unqualified or however little initiative or however great losses he had in creativity, they were with him. They just would do what he said. And that's the loyalty that they brought as well. All right. The third point, which is probably obvious from the story itself. I should talk about Jael. I'm sorry, Jael. The story about Jael is that she is a wife who lives in a tent, and this soldier comes and stays at her tent. You know that the best we know, these tents were mostly maintained by the women. They would be the ones who would set up the tent. I suspect she was good with one thing for sure, with a hammer and a tent peg. I don't know how many times she had to move the tent, or it blew over, or had to be fixed, or something. But she had that tool. She knew where it was, and she knew how to use it. And so rather than a sword or some other way, this man comes in who is an enemy of God. She's in alliance with God's people. He lays down and he goes to sleep. She uses what she could do. She may have thought her whole life, there's got to be more to life than driving tent pegs into the ground, if that's what she did as her, but she used that capability as well. Somewhat gruesome, and yet she used what she had, used what was at hand. And that's what we're called to do in the kingdom. As each has received a gift, use it to serve one another. As good stewards of God's varied grace, whoever speaks is one who speaks the oracles of God. Whoever serves is one who serves by the strength that God supplies, in order that in everything God may be glorified through Jesus Christ. Well, there's a third thing that's I think, maybe most important and obvious. Be a leader maker. And you know who that is. You have to think about Deborah. And who was Deborah, actually? What do we know about Deborah? She was, first of all, a wife of someone. So I imagine she had a role, keeping with God's will, of subjection to her husband in that role. She was a prophetess. She was a mouthpiece for God. She rendered judgments as she sat under the palm tree down near Bethel. So she was a judge, deciding matters over time. But the way she describes herself, the place that we can read about that is in chapter 5 and verse 7. Village life ceased. It ceased in Israel until I, Deborah, arose. A surrogate leader, a nudger of cowardly men. What was she? She said, I arose a mother in Israel. Her description of herself was a mother. I don't know if she had literal children or not. I think that's a description of her role as doing what mothers do. And you know, there are a lot of opportunities for mothers, figurative mothers, to do what they need to do to make leaders. There are several things she did. First of all, she called for Barak and said to him, you have a role to play. You have something important that God wants you to do. Are there mothers here that do that? I have some personal stories about that. I remember being considered to be an elder and feeling very, very unworthy. And there were several people who came to me and said, Marty, you have some things you need to work on. And guess who those people mostly were? In fact, the best comments were all from the mothers at the church where I was, the mothers at Embry Hills. And I don't necessarily mean that they had children. They were the people who cared enough to push their sons and those men who perhaps were reluctant to do what they should do, to do it because God had asked them to do it in some way. And we think about other leader makers in the Bible. First one we think about would be the parents of Timothy, Lois and Eunice, a grandmother and mother. Okay, so Jeff told me that all the electronic devices keep this clicker from working, so maybe, anyway. Lois and Eunice taught Timothy. And they were his mothers and led him to be the great soldier that Paul describes in those letters to Timothy. Jesus selected and trained and encouraged the 12. Barnabas sought Saul to be a teacher in Antioch. Aquila and Priscilla corrected Apollos and used that great power that he had and eloquence in the word and directed in the right direction. Paul selected and trained a number of men, Timothy, John Mark, Titus, Silas, and others. What a great multiplier to be a leader maker, to take someone who knows that what they ought to do and push them into that, or teach them better what they need to do, help them, encourage them, and go with them. And I think that's the second area that you can be leader makers. Barak said to her, if you will go with me, then I will go, but if you will not go with me, I will not go. And she said, I will go with you. That's a way to be a leader maker, is to sign up and enlist like those tribes that came and were sitting at the feet of Barak or following him as one man. How many times are there some initiatives? Something I think about, leaders in the church, and we think about their qualifications, and we may be projecting the image of corporate or political leaders and saying, you know, there's no one in the church with that kind of charisma and creativity and intelligence and action-oriented character and all of that. And we talked about this a little yesterday. That's not in the list in 1 Timothy 3 or Titus 1 for qualifications of elders. It's not. It's all related to their character. And whatever kind of judgment they have to offer, it probably didn't make the best sense to go charging down off of that mountain. But that's what they were asked to do, to offer themselves willingly. If someone has a plan and we sign up for it, we are making them a leader. Whatever qualifications or shortcomings they might have. Phoebe, I commend you to Phoebe, who is a servant of the church in Cenchrea, that you may receive her in the Lord in a manner worthy of the saints, and assist her in whatever business she has need of you, for she's been a helper of many and myself also. Do you see a kind of a transitive property? She's a helper of many. She has some good ideas. Let's go help her in whatever she needs to do, if it's a good thing to do. There's an interesting reference in the last chapter of 1 Corinthians to the house of Stephanas, I think that's misspelled. It should be N-A-S. I urge you, brothers, you know that the household of Stephanas were the first converts in Asia. We don't know much more about that except a little about their baptism in chapter 1. They have devoted themselves to the service of the saints. Be subject to such as these, to every fellow worker and laborer. That language is reminiscent of our responsibility to those who have the rule over us in the Lord, isn't it? And who was Stephanas? I don't know. What was his family doing? I don't know, but it was a good thing. And Paul says to them, you sign up, and as followers, you have made them into leaders. So look around and see who are those who ought to be leading, who could be taking the initiative, if they just had someone to encourage them and others, perhaps ourselves, to follow. I just want to say this as maybe part of the follow-up to yesterday. I don't know where the men ended up with regard to their personal assessments, with their leadership in their own homes or as fathers. I hope some, and I believe they did, made the resolve to try something new, something, some little thing. And it might be to improve a relationship with a wife, to improve the spiritual activities in the home, to make the family more dedicated, to rule out more of the worldly activities. I don't know what you resolved to do, men, that were here yesterday. But let me tell you, those who will now be under them, make them leaders, wives, kids. If they have an idea, help them, encourage them, sign up for it. Don't second guess it. Make it happen. Isn't that the secret of effective leadership, is to have willing people who will say, I'm going to do it. It's right. And I'll take whatever judgment you have, and I'm going to run with it and make it better. And I'll bring what talents I have to the game. I believe that's the secret of the church here. There's so often just a small number of people who almost do everything with regard to edifying and teaching and searching out for the lost sheep and reaching out in evangelism and just keeping the place running so it's efficient and comfortable for the Bible teaching and things that go on. Can you sign up for that and be a leader? And make others leaders and support that, bringing whatever talents you have. That's the secret. That will make these elders, and I don't know them very well, but they're not supermen, I know that. And they have limitations, and they don't know everything, but they can be so successful as leaders if the people offer themselves willingly. So that's the secret of successful leadership. Showing up, use the skills you have, and being a leader maker. Let's read the verse again. Oh, I should just say, when it's all done, it really isn't us at all. It's God who fought the battle. You can see that through this whole description, really, of how this turned out, both in the poem and in the description. Lord, when you went from Seir, when you marched from the field of Eden, the righteous acts of the Lord, the righteous acts for his villagers, the Lord came down for me against the mighty. God subdued Jabin. It's God that did it. It's not the men or even those who followed. It's not Barak or those who followed him. So looking at the kingdom, God rules in the midst of his enemies. Jesus is the victorious king sitting at the right hand of God. But that forceful rule does not characterize his people. Your people offer themselves willingly, freely, on the day of your power and in holy garments. And so that leads us to the invitation this morning. Are you offering yourself, your life, willingly to the king? I think our opportunity to follow men, imperfect men, is just a shadow of our willingness to submit our life to God. In fact, maybe that's the way it's implemented in many ways. Are you willing to submit your life in every aspect? Bring the tools you have, the skills you have, and be subject to him in every way? That's the invitation this morning. If you can do something, then we can help with in a public way, make that known. If not, make the changes in your life as necessary. Think about that as we sing the song together.